This is an extract from Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which links two of the main characters in Nigel Farndale's The Blasphemer. Shortlisted for the 2010 Costa Novel Award, in this modern take on the First World War, protagonist Daniel Kennedy finds himself drowning in both a literal sense and with guilt. Nigel, it is a delight to welcome you to the Radio 2 Art Show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for asking me.
I want to say many things to you. One, I love your interviews. You've won awards for your interviews. How irritating is it to be interviewed? You can be honest before we embark on this chat.
Well, I don't know. I haven't been interviewed enough, really, to get a measure of it. But, the actual process of interviewing is often more a matter of listening, careful listening, and asking pertinent wise when the sort of conversation stalls and someone is desperate to expand but are holding themselves back. And so it's a sort of art of teasing out, which I'm sure you've experienced too.
I just want to know, I felt bad. How excited are you to be nominated for the award? And also you've got quite a big fuss because I believe you're on Richard and Judy's book club. That must be, I mean, years after, not years, but after having written it, and then it comes out in paperback, to have that fuss must really help and be lovely for you.
It is a nice feeling, and it is an incredibly slow and torturous process, really. I mean, this book took me, well, I suppose about 8 years ago I first had the idea for it, and then it sort of stops and starts and off and on, and I did a non-fiction book in between, but I've also got a day job, so it was sort of impinging on weekends and evenings and that sort of thing. So to finally sort of see it in and particularly the W.H. Smith and giving it a good push, and it's all on their shelves and prominent display, so it is exciting. Yeah, it's nice.
Let's talk about the title, because I read, this might be untrue, so please don't shout at me, but it was a brilliant quote, which is, you found naming a book just as hard as naming a child. And I believe it was called Other Things. Why did you pick with The Blasphemer? Before we talk about the story in detail.
It is incredibly hard finding the right book, because you're sort of full of doubt in it until you eventually settle on a title that just feels, you feel comfortable with. Yeah. And there were a few false starts. It was Certainty for quite a while.
I like Certainty. I mean, I love The Blasphemer.
And then I saw another book called Certainty, so that went out the window.
Yeah.
And,
The Long Swim.
The Long Swim, yeah, that was quite nice. But again, there were sort of, there were other longs out there, so I was trying to come up with something a little more fresh. I mean, I suppose the publishers were slightly nervous in that they didn't want it to have a sort of overtly religious connotation, because it's not a book about religion. The Blasphemer is more a metaphorical idea that I'm playing with, that actually it's a blasphemy to leave the one you love behind, which is what happens in the sort of central incident. And also what was happening in the trenches was a form of blasphemy. And there was the artist Paul Nash, in a letter to his wife in 1917 from Passchendaele, described this blasphemy he looked out across no man's land and saw, which I thought was very vivid. It's a powerful idea.
Let's talk about the book. As I mentioned, the central character is Daniel, his girlfriend or life partner or whatever you call him, Nancy. They go on holiday. Tell me, pick it up from there if you can.
Yeah, it's a surprise holiday, because he was hoping to propose. And he's a zoologist, and so it's slightly a work thing for him to actually go to the Galapagos Islands. But they never actually make it on a short flight on a seaplane from Quito to the Galapagos Islands. The plane ditches into the sea, and in a moment of panic, Daniel scrambles over the woman he loves to save himself first, and then realizing
what he gets over it.
Yeah, realizing what he's done, he gets up to the surface and then comes back and rescues her. But by then, everything has changed in their relationship. And that was the core of the book. I really wanted to explore what would happen to a loving relationship when it's tested in that way.
Yes, because none of us are tested in that way. And, I mean, what's so fascinating is after the crash, because he's a zoologist, which is what I love, he knows all kinds of facts. He goes, look, this is how it works. I think there was 13 in the plane plus two pilots, I think. I don't want to give too much away, but, he says however many people survive, and that's just what happens. There's a number of people, if all of us went through an experience, there are some people who just save themselves.
Yeah, statistically, they're life survivors. They will sort of find a way to get out of an emergency situation by whatever means. Equally, there's those who are just prone to freeze up, and they're the ones who tend to get left behind. Yeah. But the impulse to save yourself is a fascinating one.
I think he's very hard on himself. I wanted to jump into the book and go, no, Daniel, it's
when
safe.
I was doing
you
my...
still love her. By the way, you still went down and you didn't say, I'm free.
When I was doing my research for it, I came across examples of mothers who'd actually left their children behind in plane crashes and only realised once they'd got outside. It's that powerful an instinct for self-preservation.
Yeah.
So equally, the power, the instinct toward altruism is fascinating, because we are these animals who are primed, who are programmed to save ourselves. And just this week, there's been some fascinating examples of it. The little boy in Australia, the 13-year-old, who choked me up looking at that picture. It was because I've got a son the same age. And he wanted them to rescue his younger brother first.
Yeah.
And that meant sacrificing himself. Quite extraordinary.
The plane crash scene, I should warn people, is so realistic and so sort of extraordinary. We'll talk about the First World War scenes as well, which are so heartbreaking. You must have done so much research into every single aspect. That's how it felt to me. I felt like you had spoken to people who had either been in a plane that had gone into the city, or you'd read report after report after report.
Yeah, I did do a lot of research into what actually happens in plane crashes. And it was partly, if there's one sort of autobiographical strand in the novel, it's my own fear of flying, which I'm slightly better about now because I've done a lot of it. I have to fly to America quite a lot for work. And so I'm sort of okay with it now. But I said that core thing of imagining yourself in that situation is what I was really wanting to explore. So the reactions of people, all that, the way, you know, a plane can spiral and all that sort of thing.
And just the noise. You're so brilliant on the noise. I just had to say that. Let's talk about the link then with his grandfather, Andrew, who you go back to. Why was it important for you? Is it because of your own grandfather to get that bit of the story in?
Well, yes, there is a parallel narrative, and I wanted to explore in that a sense in which there might be a bravery gene and equally a cowardice gene, because as a zoologist, Daniel is intrigued by this as well, and he wants to know why he's sort of been missed out, because as far as he can say, it's actually his great-grandfather. It's rather the timing of it, rather than his grandfather. The timing of it was, it would have been much more sensible to have him as a grandfather, but his age didn't quite work, because we've got to now to that stage where it's beyond 90 years since the First World War, and so the timing wouldn't keep him in his 30s, which it needed to be. But the exploring it again, it was an exercise in empathy. I think I did a lot of research into the First World War and went to the battlefields, partly because my grandfather had fought there and I'd sort of grown up listening to his stories. I knew him very well because he was nearly 90 when he died, and he would talk about his time at Passchendaele, and I think it affected him throughout his life.
Your dedication in the book almost made me cry at the beginning. I believe it's to your grandfather. Can you read? I can't remember the exact wording.
Yes, can I? Here we go. For my grandfather, Private Alfred Farndale, who died in the mud of Passchendaele, and again 70 years later in his bed.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of the idea behind that was that everyone who fought in that most horrific of battles did die there.
Yeah.
They even those who survived, and that was something which Siegfried Sassoon explored in his poem about it. I died in hell. They called it Passchendaele.
It's incredibly moving. Thank you so much for coming in. We haven't explored lots of other things that we could for hours, but then I'd get into trouble. But thank you very, very much for coming in and talking about your book. The Blasphemer by Nigel Farndale is published in paperback this coming Thursday by Black Swan. And we'll be discussing the 2010 Costa Book Awards with author Jason Wallace and our book critic Alex Hemmingsley on next week's show. Nigel, thank you.
Thank you.